you take it, take your seats, please. Well, our session of this morning, I'm delighted to introduce John Mayer, who's presently at AU, but soon, I'm pleased to say, moving up to join us in Sydney. John's going to be speaking to us on the disunity of the modals. Welcome, John.
Yeah, thanks, Hugh, and thanks, everyone, for coming. There's a hand up going around, and there should be some in the back if you don't have one. Maybe a prefatory remark about how this talk bears on what I take to be the orienting question of this conference, which is roughly, ought we be expressivists about the modals? So I guess my view is, stated at that level of generality, the question rests on a false presupposition. From the semantic, and I'm going to say from the metaphysical point of view, there are really two quite different types of modality. And one of these, the first of these, roughly corresponds to epistemic modality, and I think may well call for an expressivist or other non-factualist sort of treatment. The other is somewhat less familiar in contemporary philosophy, and that's one I think we ought to be realist about, although the realism I myself endorse is a rather modest sort of response-dependent realism. So hopefully I'll get to some of those deeper points, as well as some thoughts about how, although the modals are semantically and metaphysically disunified, how they're in a certain sense cognitively unified, at the end of the talk, time permitting. I reckon I'll go to about 12:10 now, so hopefully by 12:50, 12:55 at the latest. So the topic, my topic, is alethic modality. Now, it would be nice to have a kind of general characterization of that sort of thing. And you can go about that philosophically or semantically. Philosophically, the problem is there seems to be no general characterization that's not hopelessly tendentious. Semantically, the problem is rather different. The term alethic is rarely used by linguists. And when they do use it, they use it in a much narrower sense than the way I'm going to be using in this talk. So the best way I know how to introduce the subject matter is just by extension. So this is the sort of thing that Kripke is trying to get you to grok onto when he talks about lecterns and the queen. It's also the stuff about the laws and all that stuff. It's kind of alethic modality in the clearest thing to say is it's what's left over when you take away epistemic modality and take away deontic modality. It's the remainder, this alethic stuff. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. So I'm going to talk about two theses that I think are quite prevalent, and the main one is going to be the operator thesis. So alethic modality, in the sense just talked about, is properly represented by an operator on propositions or sentences. Now, this can seem like a highly technical point. I mean, you think operator, schmoperator, it's not really that important. I think that would be a mistake. This seems to be a quite deeply shared presupposition among theorists of modality all across the board, all the way from David Lewis, on the one hand, to conventionalists of the sort that Amy Thomason was discussing yesterday. And it's a kind of foundation on which a whole bunch of contentious theories about modality are built. And when you take the foundation away, those crumble, to put it in the strongest possible terms. The second thesis is what I'm going to call the unity thesis, which is, in this sense at least, there might be all sorts of differences between alethic and modality and epistemic modality, but in this sense at least, they're unified. This is true of epistemic modality too, so in that respect, alethic modality and epistemic modality are unified. The plan of this talk is to appeal to semantic considerations to put pressure on the operator thesis. And since those same semantic considerations give evidence the operator thesis is true of epistemic modality, thus indirectly put pressure on the unity thesis. That's the plan. Now, there are two sorts of views from which one can approach these issues, at least two sorts of views. The first of them is prominent, especially among kind of our great modal metaphysicians like Kripke and Lewis. This is to take up the point of view of modal logic. And when you do take up the point of view of modal logic, the operator thesis, as it were, stares you in the face. You see this, there's this thing, it's like a diamond, and then there's a little letter next to it, and that's an operator on a proposition or a sentence, or you got a box. So epistemic modality works the same way. You just maybe give different axioms. So when you view matters from the point of view of, another way you can approach this is from the point of view of natural language. That is, how we actually talk about alethic modality in the natural languages, and what the logical form or you know, semantic structure, a syntactic structure of those sorts of things is. I'm going to argue when you approach things from that point of view, things look rather different. Now, of course, how much you care about that will depend on how seriously you take that point of view. I think one ought to take it rather seriously, but I won't give much argument for that here. So, as a little entree into these issues, I want to talk about a minor little issue that kind of gives some sense of the difficulties. So this is what I'm going to call a kind of minor embarrassment for the orthodoxy, which is just the conjunction of the operator thesis and the unity thesis. So one way of thinking about the orthodox view is thinking possible works a lot like believes. So believes is also an operator on sentences. And lo and behold, you look at English and you say, John believes that snow is white, and good, it's a belief ascription, just like we want it. When you try to do that with possible, it doesn't work out so well. So it's possible that P, where P is in the indicative mood, always expresses epistemic modality in English, a footnote on that always presently. This has been argued by a bunch of people. Maybe the locus classicus is Keith DeRose's article on epistemic possibility from 91. The footnote on the always. So often when I present this sort of claim to philosophers, they say, aha, no. See, it's possible that there are talking donkeys. I don't mean epistemic modality. I mean alethic modality. I refute you thus. That, I think, is a deeply suspicious sort of response. So I found again and again when philosophers use constructions in certain ways that aren't just idiosyncratic or sort of academic. They violate laws that, when you look to the linguistics literature, are deep laws about natural language. So I think the following is a live empirical hypothesis. So there's this phenomenon known as pigeons, which, two communities get up and they have to do trade, so they get up a kind of code among themselves, but not really a natural language. You couldn't teach it to a child. And so if you wanted to study the semantics of natural language and how they were reflecting the structure of thought, you would do poorly to study a pigeon. So I think it's a live empirical hypothesis that when it comes to the modals, at least, philosophers' language is not English, but a pigeon, homophonic with English, for the most part. So that leads me to take a somewhat dim view of philosophers' linguistic intuitions, and so of my own. So what I like to do is corpus searches on text. So I'm going to use the COCA, this collection of colloquial American English, which is spoken, written, stuff like that, and you can just do searches and see what actually occurs. So when you do a search for possible that, I haven't been able to find any. It's rare to get such unanimity in these things, but I haven't been able to get any metaphysical readings. I'd be very interested if someone could find one. The closest I could find, this is it's a lawyer testifying within a science fiction story. And so he says, it's possible that I have green skin and wiggly red antennae. So that sounds like a Leafic modality. But then he immediately says, or at least that I had them in January. And so that makes it quite clear that he's backtracking and saying, actually, relative to your evidence, it's not possible. So he's retracting the claim. Then he goes on and says a bunch of improbable things and says, if you believe those things, then you should also believe this other testimony. So it's quite clear, even in that context, that it expresses epistemic modality. So this seems to be a quite, that's a bit jokey, but this is a quite serious phenomenon in natural language that puts pressure on the operator thesis, a little pressure, at least when it comes to English. So here's a common remark that may be relevant. It's quite common. So you read these, there are all these linguists kind of attempts to categorize modality, and inevitably there's a paragraph that says, sometimes I hear philosophers talk about alethic or metaphysical modality. This appears to be unmarked in natural languages. I have no idea what they're talking about, and then kind of move on. So it's a quite common idea about linguists, among linguists. Also, you occasionally kind of hear it whispered in the hallway by philosophers that alethic modality of the type that Kripke and Lewis are talking about isn't really something that's expressed in natural language. So I think this idea is true but misleading. I think there's nothing exactly corresponding to the philosopher's alethic modality in natural language. But to borrow an idea from the Canberra planners, so named by Hugh, there are various candidates for the alethic modality role. And in particular, there's a best deserver for the alethic modality role. And so I want to now discuss three candidates and focus on the third of them, which I will take to be the best deserver. So the first is the subjunctive conditional. If I were to drop this glass, it would break. And these are much more marginal in natural language than is commonly supposed by philosophers. Nonetheless, they're quite important and quite clearly elithic. I'm just going to plead ignorance on this point. The subjunctive conditional, as everyone knows, extremely difficult, and I have nothing especially new to say about it. If people want the Q&A, I can make some remarks about where I think the subjunctive conditional fits into the general picture I'm going to sketch, but I'm just going to set it aside. Another construction, so Ian Hacking has a really lovely paper that never gets cited from the Phil Review in like 1975, where he makes very similar points to the ones I'm going to make in this talk. And he focuses on the phrase, it's possible for X to F. That's also clearly elithic in English. It's possible for me to eat a sandwich means roughly I have the power to eat a sandwich. Again, I'm going to plead difficulty on these sorts of things. The 4-2 construction is extremely complicated. So Martin Hackle at MIT has pointed out that 4-2 generates modality all on its own. So the teachers found books for the students to read. That has a deontic reading. You know, all the books were pornographic and the students weren't allowed to read them, so the teacher found books for the students to read. And it also has a circumstantial reading. I'll explain what that means presently. The books were all in German. The students couldn't read German, so the teacher found books for the students to read. So it's very mysterious where the modality is coming from in it's possible for X to F. Is it coming from the possible? Is it coming from the 4-2? Is it coming from both in some sort of combination? So again, I'm just going to plead ignorance on this sort of matter. Also, a little footnote that these are slightly more marginal natural languages than the ones I'm going to focus on. So what I'm going to focus on is circumstantial modality, typically expressed in English by the modal auxiliary can. For those who are not familiar, so the typical, there's nothing like an orthodox way of carving up modality among linguists, but the closest thing to an orthodoxy is it's kind of a three-noded tree. So there's epistemic, and then there's root. Epistemic we've already talked about. Root subdivides into deontic, like ought and so forth like that, and then circumstantial. So circumstantial is claims about ability are the kind of canonical example of circumstantial modality. He has the ability to do this. And it can be attributed to objects. You know, given that I placed my cup on the edge of the table, it can topple over, even though that's a bit strained, perhaps. But these are clearly not epistemic, not deontic, and they clearly, in some sense, have to do with how things actually are in the world, rather than how they are relative to my evidence, or how they are relative to the norms of society, and stuff like that. So they if they're anything at all, they're elithic. Oh, conversely, if elithic modality is anything at all, that is, if it has a deserver in natural language, it's circumstantial modality. And so if you buy that, then your semantics for circumstantial modality are going to be a good guide to how you should think about elithic modality. So I want to look quite seriously at the modal auxiliary can and draw some what you might call metaphysical conclusions from looking at it. That brings us, I believe, to section 3, the behavior of can. So I've already rather covered 3.1. Can is the core circumstantial modal in English. There are others, less common, has the ability to, stuff like that. But I'm going to just focus on can for now. I think the other ones fit even more nicely with my thesis than can does. So if you can show it for can, I can show it for them. I won't argue for that, but I'm happy to talk about it. So here's a conjecture about can. Indicative sentences of this form, X can F, in English, never express epistemic modality, never. And note, we're not just talking about a conventional phenomenon. So there is this convention that everyone's familiar with, that the student says, can I go to the bathroom? And the teacher says, don't say that, say may. So that's not an interesting phenomenon. That's just the use of certain modals in that way is just a kind of high status signaling device to show that you've gone to fancy schools. It's uninteresting. The deontic reading of can is perfectly good. So can has a deontic reading, meaning permission, and it has a circumstantial reading, roughly ability, but it has no epistemic reading, so I claim. Again, people, you know, philosophers give me counterexamples. I just looked at the corpus. This is not fully decisive. This is a random 500 samples, and I got for he can be, which inevitably figured in the philosopher's counterexamples. I ran 500 and got two that were epistemic. So I haven't talked to Jeff in about 2 months, and I don't have no idea where he can be. Again, double negation is completely fine. It's the he can be that's substandard on this hypothesis. He can be, then this is in the O.J. Simpson trial, he can be all kinds of crazy things. Does that mean he's lying about finding a glove? I can't quite tell whether that's meant as intended as epistemic or circumstantial in the context. So, one's not going to get, it's a very interesting question, what constitutes statistical significance for a corpus search, which I don't have a good answer to, and I'd like to very much. But 400, so out of 500 examples, 498 confirm the thesis. Two disagree with the thesis and occur in dialogues that are otherwise marked as substandard. They take place on television shows with ordinary people who are under pressure and stuff like that. So that strikes me as evidence for the conjecture that X can F never expresses epistemic modality in English, and those two alleged counterexamples are simply ungrammatical as natural language sentences. Now, of course, one doesn't want to track superficial features of English, especially because modal constructions vary in certain conventional ways that I'll talk about presently. And those variations, one wouldn't expect to be preserved across natural languages. So if something is preserved across natural languages, that's a clue that it's important. Can is rather robust in this way. So one has evidence of this in languages quite removed from English. So Russian, so we moved to could for the epistemic. In other languages, instead of changing the tense on the verb, you add a little operator that, as it were, has the effect of taking the subjunctive. So in Russian, one adds bits, and that takes you to the epistemic. So the, as it were, the bare one expresses circumstantial deontic. You add in this thing, it takes you to epistemic. In Mandarin, exactly the same thing happens. The bare thing is circumstantial deontic. You add in la, which takes you to the epistemic. So it appears to be cross-linguistically robust. Not entirely. So Angelica Kratzer, who's going to be the kind of opponent in part four of this talk, in her great paper from 1981, The Notional Category of Modality, produces this sentence as perfectly fine as having an epistemic reading. And apologies for my pronunciation. So der Kassenjakel kann der Mörder sein, where it's can, K-A-N-N. So she says, oh, clearly epistemic. In conversations with my native speaker colleagues, this is regarded as strained, maybe not quite ungrammatical, strained at least, but maybe admissible. Wolfgang Schwartz pointed out to me rather amusingly that Katzenjakel is a kind of a Bavarian name, and the Bavarian dialect is kind of marked as substandard and kind of low class, and so that makes the sentence come out more acceptable. Setting that aside, even if I'm not, there is, of course, the German construction es kann sein das, which is clearly epistemic. So even if Kratzer is wrong about can, she at least has that construction. I've also found evidence of Norwegian has a modal auxiliary that's clearly a syntactic descendant or has a shared descendant with the English can, and that also expresses epistemic modality. It would be interesting to have a story about how this goes. I mean, as I hopefully will get to at the end of the talk, there's developmental evidence that children acquire circumstantial and deontic modals and then later acquire epistemic modals as a sort of projection of them. The projection part is contentious. The first part, though, is empirically established. So one might think perhaps that happens in natural languages, too. Eventually, eventually takes on epistemic readings, but I have no good story about how that goes, so it's a bit mysterious to me. One other thing that's trouble for my, but that said, back to the good side, it's extremely cross-linguistically robust. We're not just dealing with a conventional phenomenon. Even if it doesn't hold everywhere, it appears to be quite a deep phenomenon. Another interesting problem for my, not a problem, just an interesting question. So negatives obviously get an epistemic read in English. So he cannot be the murderer because here's evidence that so-and-so is the murderer. That obviously has an epistemic reading. I didn't realize this until I read this in a paper by Jennifer Coates, but interrogatives seem to create an epistemic reading, these kind of pop song constructions, like, can it be that he loves me, or something like that, where that's kind of wondering whether it's possible relative to my evidence that he loves me, although it has that reading at least. So again, a bit mysterious on my proposal. why this happens. I was recently reading a paper by Kai von Fintel where he says, it's utterly mysterious to everyone why this happens. So I am at least in good company on that point. But the section three has just all been a defense of an empirical hypothesis, which is that sentences of the form X can F never express epistemic possibility, and that result is significantly, although not quite universally, cross-linguistically robust. And now we turn, so as it were, section four is going to turn to semantic, so we want a semantic explanation of that, and then we want to see what, if any, bearing that has on the metaphysics. And so, as it were, section four is going to go for a semantic explanation, and then five will delve a bit into the metaphysics. So that brings us to section four. So, what have I said thus far? So I've said the operator thesis is a kind of orthodox view about alethic modality, and that can works as a sentential operator. But aha, X can F is really tied to alethic modality in an interesting way, and so there's some problem here. Now, the standard response, I think, is at this point, there's no problem at all. This is what I call the no worries response. So the standard semantics for can, that of Kratzer, also endorsed by Lewis, is that can is indeed a sentential operator. So if can expresses alethic modality and can is a sentential operator, then so much the better for the operator thesis. So goes the no worries response. Now, I think this strategy is at this point of the argument dialectically ineffective. And here's why. The conjecture defended in section three, inter alia, puts pressure on the standard view of can. And here's why. So as people are probably familiar with, Kratzer 77 sketches a picture where all modals are to be treated in terms of quantifiers over possible worlds. So they're the necessity modals, like must, and they say all in a bunch of worlds have a certain property, and they're the possibility modals, like may or can, where it has one in that class has a certain property. In a way that should be familiar. So on this kind of picture, there's no interesting deep distinction between the various flavors of modality. They all have the same underlying structure. Now, Kratzer, of course, recognizes that sometimes you get a certain modal construction tied to a certain flavor of modality. You know, might is tied to epistemic in English. So Kratzer 81 introduces a mechanism to explain this. So her thought is the flavor of modality is determined by conversational background, intuitive idea. Furthermore, there's this phenomenon of stereotypical conversational background. It's not quite a semantic phenomenon, but it's not quite pragmatic either. Like conventional implication, it kind of lives the semantic-pragmatics interface. So as it were, it's a conversational background that kind of is mandatory. All conversations are governed by this background. And the conversational background says something like, don't use might for non-epistemic modality. Now, on this picture, you will get an explanation of why certain modals are tied to certain flavors. But the explanation is in some deep sense conventional. It just so happens that the stereotypical conversational background is set in a certain way. And if that's right, the issues here are quite deep, and I don't know of a good discussion of Kratzer on this, so that should be put under a conditional. If that's right, then the evidence from 3.4 puts strong pressure. It says, no, this isn't just a conventional phenomenon. It's a deep cross-linguistic phenomenon, and you want an explanation for that. So no good appealing to the conjecture at this point in the argument. We've just put strong pressure on the conjecture. No good appealing to the standard semantics. We've just put pressure on the standard semantics, so I claim. There's further problems for the standard semantics. There's this substitution phenomenon. So you can typically just, so Jennifer Coates says canon is able to in English just synonymous. That doesn't seem right to me, but something nearby seems right. That whenever you have a can, you can, as it were, take it out and swap in a predicate. Which predicate is going to be appropriate will depend on the conversational context. So if I say, John can now, speak English, that gets a, John presently has the ability to speak English. you know, John can now speak Russian, maybe means John can be, has the potential to speak Russian in the sense that he could with proper training, but you can always swap in a predicate with the relevant predicate being determined by conversational context. Epistemic models don't behave this way. It's an interesting question whether deontics do. But it's not, you know, it might be raining, and you can, there's no natural synonym that one can just swap in there. One can, of course, say it's possible relative to my evidence that it's raining, or something like that. But it's an asymmetry between the circumstantials and the deontics. Another interesting asymmetry pointed out by Barbara Vetter in her dissertation at Oxford recently. So she appeals to this test devised by Stalnaker and Thomason to test whether an adverb is operating over a sentence or whether it's operating like a predicate. And the test is whether you can swing the adverb out front. John walks to school, unfortunately. Unfortunately, it can, of course, swing out front. It's unfortunate that John walks to school. John walks to school slowly, however, isn't operating over the sentence in that way, and that's why you can't say it is slow that John walks to school. Slow is directly modifying the walking rather than working like a sentential operator. And Vetter points out correctly, I think, that can fails this test. So may satisfies this test. So the rain might fall. The rain might fall. It might be that the rain falls. Those mean the same thing. John can swim. It can be that John swims. If the second reading has a reading in English at all, it's not, I think, synonymous with the first. So again, this is, remember, the Kratzer semantics is one on which can is a sentential operator. The Thomason-Stalnaker test is a test for whether something's a sentential operator for adverbs rather than modal auxiliaries. Can fails the Thomason-Stalnaker test, therefore another strike against the view that can is a sentential operator. I'm going to sketch an alternate view of can, defended by Kratzer in her dissertation, and it seems to me exactly right. It's the thought is that X can F is basically a can F in X can F is a predicate. Can's not behaving as a sentential operator. So the logical form of X can F is not can out front and then XFs, but rather X can F, where the can F is a predicate on X. So it's just like a rose is red, where the relation between red and rose in that sense is the same as the relation between swim and between can swim and John in John can swim. So that's the idea. It's really operating as a predicate rather than a sentential operator. So this explains the conjecture quite naturally. Predicates in English are typically talking about the properties of things rather than expressing epistemic modality. So you would expect the predicate in English would be forbidden from expressing epistemic modality. It also naturally explains the substitution phenomenon. If can F is indeed a predicate, no mystery that you can just swap in another predicate, which one determined by the conversational context, without loss of meaning. And finally, on the face of it, it satisfies the Thomason-Stalnaker test. Why does can fail the Thomason-Stalnaker test? Because it's a predicate rather than a sentential operator. So what have I done at this point? I've defended a certain empirical thesis about the behavior of can, and I've given a semantic explanation for that. This might at this point seem a bit distant to you from the metaphysics, so I'm going to try to draw it closer at this point. So the operator thesis, recall, was the thesis that elithic modality is an operator on sentences or propositions. I've given a two-step argument against that claim. First, we should adjudicate that thesis partly by looking at the behavior of expressions, I should say a three-point thesis. First, methodological, we should adjudicate that thesis partly by looking at the behavior of elithic modalities and their semantics in natural language. Second, the best deserver for the name elithic modality is circumstantial modality. Third, circumstantial modality doesn't behave as a sentential operator. It behaves as a predicate. One could obviously get off the boat at any of those three points. I say that not as a knockdown argument, but just to illuminate the structure of what's been argued. If you buy all those three things, that puts pressure on, although it hardly refutes the operator thesis. indirectly, obviously, that puts pressure on the unity thesis as well. Because I've been implicitly assuming, and it seems exactly right, that epistemic modality does behave as a sentential operator in natural languages. So the unity thesis turns out to be false, at least when it comes to natural language. We have one sort of modality that's kind of alethic slash, I should say, a mystery where deontic goes on this picture. Maybe it goes in both places. But we have one sort of modality that's alethic and works as a predicate, another that's a sentential, that's epistemic and works as a sentential operator. And they're really quite different at this, from the semantic point of view. That brings us to 5.3 on the possibility that we've learned nothing at all from this. There's an old tradition among philosophers of just thinking that here's what you do. You give truth conditions. Done that correctly, your job is done. I've raised no objections to the claim that Kratzer gives perfectly adequate truth conditions for canon English. What I've claimed is the semantics doesn't at all match the syntax or what one might more provocatively call the logical form of these sentences. So whether any of this is important at all will depend on what you think, what you want your semantic theory to do, whether you really want it to track the structure of the sentences or whether just delivering truth conditions is enough. I obviously think, if possible, you ought to track the structure, but all this is conditional on agreeing with me about that. So that's the sense in which we might, that is, if you deny this assumption, say that we've learned nothing at all from this. So that's a pessimistic note. A tad more optimistic note. So there's a traditional view of alethic modality, sometimes called Aristotelian, on the basis of some sketchy remarks in Metaphysics Theta, on which this traditional way of thinking about alethic modality is just completely wrong. Here's how alethic modality works. You're ascribing powers to objects. You're not making a claim about how things might be were the world different. You're literally ascribing a power to an object, a potentiality or a liability. That sort of view of possibility, and I myself hold such a view with a bit of an anthropomorphic twist, that sort of view coheres quite well with the semantics. The semantics really looks like that. It looks like here's what we do when we talk about alethic modality. We ascribe powers and liabilities to objects rather than giving a sentential operator, which corresponds to something more like the possible worlds picture of modality. So again, all highly conditional. If you bought my semantics and you took semantics quite seriously, it leads you to a much more kind of Aristotelian or neo-Aristotelian view of alethic modality. A note at the end, and this might be a bit sketchy because I've just been thinking about this. I mean, we don't want the modals to be too disunified. It's really, and the great elegance of the Kratzer semantics is that the modals must have something in common. Kratzer says to you, here's what it is. And if I'm right, one can't avail oneself of that structure. And there is an interesting, distinct sort of pressure against the Kratzer semantics that I haven't mentioned thus far, and I'll close with, because I think it might give us a clue into how the modals are, though semantically disunified, they're in a certain sense cognitively unified. So it's quite well empirically confirmed that circumstantials and deontic modals are acquired around 2.5 in children, while epistemic modals are acquired around 3.5. Now, this phenomenon is utterly mysterious on the Kratzer semantics, on which the modals have the same structure, so you would expect children could just pick them up at the same time. So Eve Sweetser at Berkeley has pressed this as an objection against Kratzer, and her thought, which is admittedly sketchily worked out, and even more sketchy will be me reporting on it, her thought is that you first acquire this idea of kind of force and ability as well as permission and obligation that is circumstantial to deontic, and then one, as it were, internalizes it and projects it into the cognitive domain. So epistemic modality is guided by a certain sort of metaphor. One's thinking about forces and powers and permissions and obligations, and then one's kind of turning those inwards into the domain of thought. And that's why it takes children a year to do that, because they have to kind of pick up this metaphor. If that were right, then we would get an even deeper explanation of why alethic modality is something about which we might be realist, and epistemic modality might be treated non-factually. Because epistemic modality at the deep level is just guided by a certain sort of metaphor that doesn't correspond to anything in the world. It's created by a certain sort of, you know, picture image that gets internalized. If that cognitive story would be right, then A, it would give underlying cognitive unity, although semantic disunity, to the epistemic and deontic modals. And two, it might give you some inkling of why a lethic modality is to be treated realistically, while epistemic modality might be treated expressivistically or in some other non-factual way. So thank you.
Thank you, John. Questions? Matthew, Ray, John, and other people, please keep your hands up. Matthew first.
Okay. John, thanks for the very rich talk. I have a ton of stuff I'd like to talk to you about, but let me just try to ask you a few questions. One is kind of a about the, your setup. I guess why do you think that the choice has to be between sentential operator and predicate? Why can't there be other kinds of operators, and couldn't can go in as one of the other kinds of operators besides a sentential operator? So that's my first question. My second question is, I think a lot of interesting fair points you make about the syntax of can as contrasted with some of the other modals like might and must and stuff. But there's also kind of syntactic ways where can doesn't look like a predicate either. So if you take like believes as your comparison classes you were doing, can doesn't negate like believes. So we say he cannot do something, so we say he does not believe something, but it does. Likewise, can doesn't invert in questions like believe. Actually, so to ask a question, you say, can he do it? But to ask about belief, you say, does he believe it? So you put it inverts differently. And also, can doesn't conjugate for a person like ordinary predicates do. So you don't say, you can say, you know, I can, he can, you can. It's always can, but I believe, he believes, you conjugate for person. So can looks like it doesn't conjugate in the same way that believes does. So you get, I mean, the more general point I'm trying to make is just that it looks like there's a lot of syntactic pressure to put can not in the box of normal predicates, but also maybe under your pressure, not in the box of normal sentential operators. So why not think that it goes in a third box?
All right. So in response to, all well taken. In response to the first question, I don't quite understand what you have in mind. Some other kind of operator.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know exactly how to work it out in the case of can, but in the case of deontic modals, for example, there's a view where you see those modals as operating not on a proposition or a sentence, but instead operating on maybe a agent-action unity, or operating on an action, rather than predicating something of the action.
Well, this might be a bit verbal for operator. I'm thinking of views like that of the deontic modals, like this view Schroeder's been defending, of course, von Richten and people like that defended. I'm thinking of that as kind of roughly in the same neighborhood of the sort of view I'm defending about circumstantial modality. So if one's using operator, so I need to use operator in a somewhat stricter sense to make it clear what I mean. So if one wants to use operator in this loose sense, then perhaps I needn't deny that.
Well, I guess the question would be, how do you represent it in your formal theory of the truth conditions? Do you represent it as a predicate letter that has satisfaction conditions, or do you represent it as an operator on something else that's already combined in certain ways?
Yeah, I was thinking that these, so again, this might, maybe we're talking past each other a bit in how we're thinking, talking about operator. When you put it in that way, then it does sound like I'm really saying operator, I'm saying cans on this side. And I don't see what, I don't quite see the contours of what the option I'm neglecting, but maybe we can talk more about that. In response to your three latter points, the first two are completely well taken. The first one turned on negatives, the second one turned in interrogatives. As I've admitted, I have no clue how can behaves in negative and interrogative context, in which context it does express epistemic modality. So those are, as it were, side effects of my ignorance on that point, so I just have nothing to say on them.
But those are often appealed to as syntactic criterion on a modal verb. And so the fact that the can inverts differently and that it negates differently than believes is evidence that it's a modal verb rather than an ordinary predicate verb.
Yeah, but I've principled reasons for thinking can behaves quite differently in negative and interrogative contexts, namely that it expresses epistemic modality in those. So I would say that's a test that will lead you astray in this case. The third point now, I meant to write it down in blank.
It was the conjugation thing.
Yeah, well, informally I'm thinking of can f as working a bit more like an adjective than a verb. So that would predict that it wouldn't conjugate.
Okay.
John.
Well, I wanted to ask about a way of expressing a leafing modality in natural language that it didn't seem to me was in one of your three categories. And it seems to me, in fact, the most common, really grammatical way of expressing kind of what philosophers are getting at, which is could have been. I could have been wearing a yellow shirt right now. Yeah. You know, where the idea is, there was some choice point in the past where I could have put on a yellow shirt and come. That's not an epistemic modal, right, in any way. Although could have been can probably be used in an epistemic way as well, right? So they can have epistemic and leafic uses. Do you see that could have been as falling under one of your three categories, or is that a different thing?
Originally, I had it should. Yeah, I should have put this more exhaustively. I think originally I had it. I had 2.51 a bit broader, so it would fall under there. So the subjunctive conditional, and or maybe we ought to put it as a fourth, the bare subjunctive, the kind of unembedded subjunctive. So the unembedded subjunctive in English appears to be quite promiscuous. That is, it can correspond to any sort of flavor of modality. So my thought is that, at that point in the talk, I'm, as it were, mainly arguing for commonness. I say, look to the most common one and look at that one. And you're claiming the could is the most common one, and so I'm overlooking could at that point. I might reject that claim. I'd actually have to check that. I suspect that comes out epistemic a lot more often than we use it epistemically, but I just don't know. But if that turned out right, I mean, there's a general, and one way of thinking of the methodology just here is, not just so earlier I expressed ignorance about the subjunctive conditional. One way is just expressing ignorance about the subjunctive, that the subjunctive is utterly promiscuous, it's mysterious what its semantics are, and just setting that aside. And so now one will think that if the subjunctive turns out to be our most prominent way of talking about a leafic modality, then the conclusions drawn in 3, 4, 5 won't follow quite so naturally. I think that's not the case, but that's something I really have to look into more.
So the conclusions, as you intend them, are supposed to be general conclusions about a leafic modality and not simply about Kant.
Yeah, there's a bit of a, so there's a footnote that I should, this corresponds to maybe, I said I could say something more about where the subjunctive conditional fits in, and so maybe I should say that now. So there does seem to be, so again, looking at things from the developmental point of view, children acquire, and this may seem like a digression, but I hope it'll be relevant. Circumstantial and deontic, and then epistemic. And then, like a year later, something that corresponds to what the linguists call leafic, which is a bit more like logical or something like that. But it does seem a bit leafic. So that's a kind of I've got this picture where there's the Aristotelian stuff over here, then the epistemic stuff over here. Where do we put that one? And so I'm quite tempted to think maybe that ultimately goes on the epistemic side. So there's this idea that Dave Chalmers and other people have that that sort of leafic modality is just sort of a reification of epistemic modality. So this might seem like I'm taking everything back, but I'm not. On this sort of view, I was presenting things a bit too simply. There are really two kinds of leafic modality, one which really corresponds to how things are in the world. So you can think of kind of Kripkean leafic modalities having two properties. One corresponding to how things really are in the world, grounded in the world, not grounded in our thought about the world, and two being represented by a sentential operator. On this more complicated way of expressing the picture, the thesis is there is no such thing as Kripkean modality. There's one leafic modality that's grounded in the world. That's the one expressed by Kant, that's the Aristotelian one, and there's one that is properly represented by a sentential operator, but that's just kind of, as it were, derived from epistemic modality in a sort of Chalmersian way. So on that more complicated way of stating the picture, that's what I'd say.
Right.
Mine has sort of turned into a follow-up, actually. So if we're looking at ordinary language discourse about the leafic modality, there are also a whole range of expressions that are, you know, questions or imperatives or something that say, you know, what if my parents had never met, or what if Hitler had been assassinated, or suppose my parents had never met, or suppose Hitler had been assassinated. And in those cases, they seem completely mundane and ubiquitous and often leading up to the sorts of statements that John was describing. Well, yeah, my parents, it could have been that my parents never met, and then
Yeah, so I put them on the category I was just introducing in response to John, and the sort of modality that's pretty elitic but strongly tied to conceivability and doesn't sustain sort of Kripkean distinctions between here's the epistemic, here's the metaphysical. So I put those. It's a good point. Yeah, these what if questions and stuff like that. I'd put that on the conceivability.
Which is never
going to
be epistemic.
I bet you'll get some epistemic creative. Wow. Yeah, who knows? It's an empirical question, but I mean, but I take the point that these questions are quite important. So we have this kind of these what ifs seem to go with the bare subjunctive and the subjunctive conditional, which are closely tied to conceivability, stuff like that. Now, an interesting question at this point, once we've distinguished these two, is which is really cognitively central. So somebody like Williamson will think, well, here's how we get on to modality. We really start thinking about counterfactuals, and then we build up our thought about modal thought from that. Or now, once we've made the distinction I made, we have another source of elitic modality in our thought, namely circumstantial thought, where we think about things, how things really could be. And from the developmental point of view, that sort of thought seems to be much earlier, and I would argue kind of more primitive. So it might, if you're really trying to look at the structure of modal thought, granting your point that we think about both these things, then you think which is more cognitively central. One hypothesis here is Pache, Williamson, and lots of other philosophers, it's a mistake to think that those what-ifs and counterfactuals are really what's cognitively central. What's cognitively central is the circumstantial things with which we begin. Although, obviously, just to open a hypothesis, who knows?
Toby.
Would like you to say a bit more about your suspicion that philosophers are speaking in pidgin. I've over the years trying to teach undergraduates about the Kripkean modality central thought experiments. I've grown increasingly apologetic over the years when I see half of them just don't get the intuition, and I've had a suspicion there's something funny and artificial about this. But yes, I'd like you to say more about the evidence that it is actually not even grammatical.
Well, the evidence is testing corpuses and seeing whether the constructions that philosophers use actually show up. And the corpuses include academic texts and stuff, so it's not like we compare the philosopher's speech to, talk shows, where you would express them. It's quite comprehensive database. And so the fact that something never shows up, of course, possible that is rather rare. So again, you'd want to look at a lot. There are certain conventional explanations about, or pragmatic Ricean explanations about why possible that wouldn't show up. And so those are going to predict in a whole bunch of cases it won't show up. So you really need to test a lot. I probably haven't tested enough to really get confirmation on this. And again, I'm ignorant on what counts as statistical significance here, but that's how you test the pidgin hypothesis with regard to any particular phrase. You go to the COCO, which is freely available online, and just test these phrases against a random database.
Would you bet on any sentence out of naming a necessity coming up as ungrammatical by these sorts of standards?
No, that's a good question.
I don't know.
David.
Yeah, so this may be a question more about what you're trying to do with all this, but suppose we grant you the empirical claim about natural language, but taking the Williamson stuff, so you already granted there seems to be some kind of connection between the subjunctive conditional and what philosophers allegedly think modality to be. So what if we just artificially defined the operator? So we've got the subjunctive conditionals, and so what Williamson shows is there's a minimal fragment of virtually any logic anyone's ever proposed, which is equivalent to the modal logic T. Pache, Williamson, the more substantive metaphysical theses of 4 and 5 look like substantive metaphysical claims, but as far as basically the modality, the stuff that everyone's going to agree to, that's just definable in terms of standard conditional logic. And moreover, you get sort of intuitive arguments that subjunctive conditionals kind of relate to the way we thought elitic modality was as an operator. So it looks like the defined box really would be what philosophers were trying to get at. So, and then this might help deflate these things you're saying about, well, elitic modality really is about powers instead of, propositions. I mean, without poo-pooing the powers, why can't there also be the propositions too? They're definable.
Yes. So the first point is I don't want to deny, so modal logic is a marvelous formal system and not a mere formalism. It's one on which we have a powerful intuitive grasp through the Kripke method and stuff like that, and it's great for describing also or one of the things. I have no objection to a clay formal system. Now, in response to your further point, I think I want to say something a bit similar to what I've already said, which is the more sophisticated position, statement of my position that I gave in response to John McFarlane, that really there's no such thing as Kripkean modality. On the one hand, there's the Lethic one that's not properly represented by a proposition, and on the other hand, there's one that is probably represented by proposition that's really closely tied to the epistemic. It's closely tied to something like conceivability. And then once you ask the question, you can ask a bunch of questions. You can ask the question that came up in conversation with Ray Langton, which is more cognitively significant. You can also ask, for philosophical purposes, which of those ought we to be using? I reckon the question is for different purposes in different domains. But I don't take any of that as deflating the core claim, which is that there's a core expression in modal language and modal thought that corresponds to a Lethic modality, and the modality that's really in the world as we talk and think about it, that corresponds more closely to the Aristotelian conception than it does to the prominent conception of Kripkean Lewis.
Can I just go quick one more time? Okay, take the subjunctive condition. Okay, now, fixing whatever the correct logic and semantics of that is, the conditional, if it were not the case that A, then would be that A, take that conditional, okay? Define box as that, box A equals that. So when we define an operator box as that conditional, it'll behave logically like a modality T, if the conditional is, you know, modus ponens, a few other things. That it seems to express some kind of modality. What is it? Is it no modality we've ever thought of before?
No, it's a modality that, as a matter of fact, derives from our prior grip of epistemics and then of conceivability, and it behaves, and it can be, and structured according.
It's really epistemic, even though the subjunctive conditionals you thought were kind of aleuthic.
They're grounded in the epistemic from a cognitive point of view, but ultimately they obey the T axiom and stuff like that. So there is such a sort of modality, and it's at least sometimes expressed in
conditionals are epistemic.
Sir,
you think that derived modality is epistemic, good, but it's because you think the subjunctive conditionals are basically epistemic.
They're in a certain sense grounded in epistemic modality in roughly this way that people think of possibilities being grounded in conceivability.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Tom.
So just a little question about your pessimism at the end.
Okay.
About, maybe it's a suggestion, we'll see, about how the syntax and the semantics, the formal semantics are related. So this is meant to be an entirely sympathetic point, so if you disagree on it, curious. So when you do your formal semantics, whether you're defining absolute truth or truth in a model, you have an object language that you define it for. You've got a nice recursive definition of the object language. And the semantics piggybacks on that. So if it is in English that you give that definition for, why would anyone interested in the semantics of English care about any such definition? I mean, so in practice, I go to lots of philosophers' talks where they define truth for some little formal language and act like they've shown me something about some natural language. But there's just this massive gap. So, but I mean, that's just grist to your mill, right? You can just wheel out that point to anyone who disagrees with, you know, this is just a response to your own pessimistic worry.
Although, to be fair, I mean, a lot of the people who think I'm wrong about this are purporting to give semantics for natural languages. So certainly Kratzer, I'd say Lewis as well, are really trying to give a semantics for the English modal auxiliary. So it's quite a powerful semantics. So there, at least, so certainly sometimes people define up formal terms, and it's often useful to do so. But the people who are my opponents at this point, who say that it can give the truth conditions completely well, even if they don't match the syntactic structure, they are at least the better among my opponents, are purporting to give a semantics for natural language. So I don't want to. Kratzer, at least, is the figure I have in mind here. So I want to grant her at least that much that she's trying to do, and does that rather well. But on my view, the semantics ends up being incorrect.
Well, so I guess I'm just asking, in what sense is that a semantics for English if you don't mention English sentences?
Kratzer does mention English sentences. There's all these sentences in German too.
Now, the next person is the person behind Tom, and whose face I can't see at the moment. No, in front of Alistair.
I didn't have a hand.
Oh, you didn't have a hand? Okay. In that case, perhaps I'm... Alistair, did you have a hand before?
Yeah.
Okay, perhaps it's you then.
So this is clarification about the operator thesis. So I'm not sure how, to what degree friends are possible.
others have to be committed to it. So I'm just thinking back to Lewis's remarks in On the Parallel World, where he says that morality is not all boxes and diamonds. There's, we need irreducible quantification over possible individuals. Without that, nothing becomes fresh. We can't give it that factory out of convenience. So is that him not agreeing with the operator thesis, or is there some sense in which he's still deeply committed to the operator thesis?
Yeah, so in that, if memory serves, in that conversational context, what Lewis is doing is he's saying, okay, for the purposes of boxes and diamonds, you don't need possible worlds, or you don't need Lewisian possible worlds. You need them for other purposes. For the purposes of boxes and diamonds, formal models are enough. And he's saying, correctly, I think that you need to do much more with modality. I think that's the context in which Lewis is speaking. So in that context, I don't take him to be rejecting the operator thesis. It's always going to be, supervenience and things like that are going to be thought of. You think of the basic objects of possibility as kind of proposition-like things. And so that's the deep sense in which I take Lewis endorses the operator thesis, even though, as he correctly notes in that passage in plurality, modality is more than boxes and diamonds. I don't take that as denial of the operator thesis.
Richard.
I wanted to ask about could as well. And how that fits in. But so just to take that to a more methodological point in response to what you said to John. Suppose you're absolutely right that the primary way of expressing the elite things turns out not to be with could, but with can. But nonetheless, could looks like it does this double timing stuff. Sometimes it's epistemic, sometimes it's elite thing. Similarly, cannot, I know you don't really want to talk about it, but clearly very often cannot is epistemic, and clearly very often it's clearly a leaving. So once you've got them double timing like that, then I take it that puts a lot of pressure on your attempt to reject the unity thesis, because if we that would mean if you reject the unity thesis that these cases are actually structurally, these verbs are actually structurally ambiguous. They could be read either as predicates or they could be read as operators. So, I wonder whether you've got some story on the view you're giving as to why there is that pressure to read some of these verbs, for some of these verbs to double time in this way.
I don't have a full story, but I don't think I want the story that you were suggesting. I agree with you, that would be a bad story. So you go to the subjunctive. I'm thinking when it comes to the subjunctive, so I won't even, as you say, I'm not talking about cannot, so the story doesn't cohere well with cannot, or at least I don't know how it would, so let's just stick with could. So could is promiscuous across epistemic, deontic, and circumstantial. So one thought would be, could is kind of syntactically, behaves in two syntactically different ways. Sometimes there's a predicate when it does circumstantial, sometimes it's an operator. I was thinking that would not be so. I was thinking these promiscuous ones would always work as an operator. And insofar as they expressed alethic modality, they would be expressing that sort of conceivability-based alethic modality that came up in my response to John McFarlane. Hardly a story, but yes, you're right. The story that you were mentioning would not be a good one.
Amy.
Yeah, I don't think I have an answer to this, but maybe just ask you. I was wondering about the some of the kinds of modal claims that you get, sort of analytic modal claims, you might say, like, I offer some sparkling wine from California to a friend and say, here, have some champagne. She says to me, champagne must come from France. Sparkling wine may come from California. Right? That's not obviously, it's not an ability kind of claim, it's not an epistemic. Are those with the conceivability sort of elitic models,
that,
you think?
Or that sounded to me like, if I got the cases right, that sounded to me like deontic. So expressing obligation or permission. Is that right? Was I getting the sentences right? Were they expressing something? You might have to give me the sentences.
So the sense were champagne must come from France.
In the sense that
probably wine made from California.
The sense that it should come from France.
No, in the sense that
it's good for it.
Because my reading of it would be, does it count as champagne because it comes
you
from France?
Violate.
Right, this is sort of European use of the term champagne. But I think it's the same kind
of
thing.
Oh, I see. Oh, I was misunderstanding. I thought you were...
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
I think of these as definitional, of course. A serious metaphysician would think of them as something else. I mean, I think it's the same sort of thing you get in a lot of first-order metaphysical discussions, too. Like, artifacts must be intentionally made, for example. Or a person must have a central consciousness or something like that. So these, I think, are sort of figure-forming metaphysical discussions. And I was just wondering where they fit on your whole scale.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's a good question. Let me, what do I want to say to this? I mean, I've generally largely been, I mean, neglecting the kind of boxy modals. I haven't said much about them. And so, now, insofar as those are epistemic, that's fine, because, you know, those can go in the traditional way, and maybe insofar as they're deontic, but there are these kind of, a tree has to be made of wood or something. Maybe that's not essential. And I'm thinking they're expressing on them. So from the metaphysical point of view, it sounds to me very much like they're expressing essence. So it's quite natural in the Aristotelian view to think of potentiality on one side and then essence on the other, to think of those as the two basic categories rather than necessity and possibility. So this kind of way of thinking of the boxing models that's been resurrected by Kit Fine. Now, so that's the natural way of thinking of the metaphysics on the sort of picture I'm thinking. Now, where does that show up in the semantics? It would be very nice. It's something I really ought to check. It would be very nice if, I mean, where are these sort of has-to things? They're not epistemic. They're not deontic. I mean, the linguists don't have many other places to put them other than the circumstantial. Now, they don't correspond to what linguists normally call circumstantial, because their circumstantial is normally a diamondy thing. It might be there's actually, within the circumstantial, there's the diamondy circumstantial and the boxy circumstantial, with the diamondy circumstantial corresponding to Aristotelian potentiality, and the boxy circumstantial corresponding to Aristotelian essence. And that would make some empirical predictions. For example, children would kind of grasp talk of essence before, for example, they grasp talk of epistemic modality.
Yeah, do you have any evidence about this?
Don't know. Yeah, thanks. Yeah,
you'd be really inclined to treat them then that with the circumstantial.
I'd very much like to.
And then be heavily realist about them rather than treating them as sort of covert deontics or other deontics.
Yeah, if, yeah, I
don't. Like
although.
Want to treat in a more deflationary way.
I'd rather like to, although it might be that I have to, you know, it might be that in light of the evidence that I have to toss them in with that category that I introduced with the kind of conceivability.
That's what I was expecting you to say there.
Yeah.
Why are you
Oh, well, because any modal should have a dual. So it would be weird if there was a category, yeah, like diamond to box.
Oh, uh-huh. Well, then these have, right, so.
Oh, sorry?
The instructional example I was given, you can do them either way, right?
Like, oh, that's not what I mean.
Champagne must be from France, but quite my maybe from California, the bus and the maze. Right?
Quite right. What I meant from the, so I've got, in circumstantial, you've got a diamond, and that corresponds to the can. So where's the box in circumstantial? You know, if you know, in the epistemic you have the diamond in the box, in the deontic you have the diamond in the box. Where's the box for the circumstantial? I was thinking it gets picked out by these has to sort of constructions. And so my reason for wanting to put these here is because I antecedently need a box down with the circumstantials. I'm sorry, I feel I'm not being clear about this, and that's partly because I haven't thought about this question enough about where exactly to locate these. But there are definitely two places they could be located, and it's partly an empirical question where they ought to be located: up here with the conceivability alethics, or down here as the dual of circumstantial. And that would fit quite nicely with the more general Aristotelian metaphysics, where one speaks of the potentiality and the essences of objects.
Sometimes a bit of both back and forth. You can't be serious.
Greg, did you have a thing?
Yeah, this issue about the appeal of there being a dual. The issue of the appeal of there being a dual to the can modality seems to trade off the fact that the can modality does have a kind of, you know, logical structure. And I'm wondering whether that comes out in your semantic picture. You know, if effing involves g-ing, then if I can f, I can g. If I can either f or g, then I can either. If I can either f or g, then I can either f. Sorry, then either I can f or I can g, and stuff like that. And I'm wondering whether those kinds of things, which seem pretty deep in our understanding of ability, which can be naturally explained on any kind of possible world story, whether they come out of the semantic picture that you have in mind.
I was hoping they did. So let me think about it. Let's see. So at first pass, I was thinking John can run has roughly the structure of, you know, Canberra is cold or something like that. And then I was thinking, John can run or swim. John can run or swim, and from Canberra is cold, you get to Canberra is cold or hot and stuff like that. But the predicate there obeys the usual logical rules.
So what about the effing involving GM?
Yeah.
So I can change.
I can run quickly, so I can run, or something like that. Or do they?
Running involves locomotion. I can run, therefore I can move.
I can run, therefore I can move. Wouldn't it just be like a case of just the way determinists and determinables work? So it's like it's that on this view that has the same structures, the sort of move from it's crimson, therefore it's red. If you're crimson, then necessarily you're red. So the rose is crimson, licenses the rose as red. Similarly, John can run, licenses John can locomote.
Well, I can see how John runs, license John moves, but why does it work under the scope of the cat? Or under the modifier of the cat?
I was thinking, but it's not really, I was thinking it's really, as it were, it's on this view, John runs is much closer to John can run than it is on the standard semantics. They're really quite alike and are just different in what they're attributing. John run attributes a property to John, running. John can run attributes a property to John, the property of having the potentiality of running.
And the question is, how does the connection between running and moving transfer to the connection between the potentiality of running and the potentiality of moving?
Can I just...
You want to say that one transfers to the other.
Yeah.
How the hell does that come out in the semantics?
How does that come out in the semantics?
You know, a standard possible world account where, you know, F involving G means in every circumstance where the F-ings are happening, the G-ings are happening too, tells you if Can, takes the person and moves them over to another possible circumstance and investigates what they're doing. Well, what they're doing is F-ing because wherever anybody F's the G-ing, that's why I've written
their
G-ing. So is your picture going to look like that semantically? Is that how potentiality is going to be understood?
Or is
it going to be a more primitive state, or unanalyzed thing?
Fair point, yeah. It looks like, I would love to have it in more deeply in the semantics, but it looks like it is going to be more unanalyzed.
And
yeah, and that's...
The question is going to be, how does competence with them doing the stuff give you those kinds of moves?
Yeah. Quite right. Okay, I see that. Thanks.
Okay, now I've got a second question from Matthew, but I just want to make sure that there were no hands unspotted. Was anybody else who had their hand up who hasn't had a question? Okay, in that case, last question from Matthew.
Well, just real quick on the dual thing, not every modal has a natural language dual, because the object on it's not clear has a natural language dual, at least if you distinguish on from must.
Hmm.
So, but anyway, that's just about the question I wanted to ask was, your paper's titled The Disunity of the Modals. But there seems to be a kind of tacit assumption that the elliptic models themselves are unified, and your story about can is going to have to influence our story about elliptic necessity. But why can't we just say the elliptic models are just unified, like you think models are just unified more generally?
Well, as it came out, as I said in the elaboration of the position in response to John McFarlane's question, the elliptics do turn out to be a little disunified on my picture. There's the kind of there's the one that goes with can, and there's the one that goes with conceivability. And so they do turn out to be a little disunified on my picture. I think once there's that much disunity, I'd say, but no more. Sort of on a general principle of not introducing disunity without reason or something like that.
Yeah, but you could still think that elliptic necessity raised certain metaphysical questions that got answered in certain ways, or certain practical questions that got answered in certain ways that are just different from the ones that are raised by Kant. Maybe Kant can always be translated into has the ability to, but that's not true of necessary.
Well, there's the general problem of what's the box for Kant? And I just want to admit that, so I have admitted that there are two kinds of elliptic modality, and then you can ask which one's important for various philosophical purposes, which one's cognitively important.
You can grant that the one you're talking about with Kant is not a propositional operator, but still hold out for the view that that one is a propositional operator.
Oh, yeah, and I'm accepting that view. But I think, again, when the picture is complexified in this way, the important point is the denial of that there's any such thing as kind of Kripkean modality, as it were. There's one that's real and in the world, and there's one that's properly represented by a propositional operator, but they don't go together.
Okay, let's thank John. A couple of reminders. One is we start again at 3 this afternoon.